Welcome to Calling the Tune with me, Sandy Burnett. Well, this week I'm in the company of Tim Robinson, who's been writing about and mapping the west of Ireland for three decades. He's had an astonishingly varied life, which he's touching upon in a new series of his essays, which are just out, entitled My Time in Space. Tim, what's your relationship with music?
It's been a rather haphazard and broken up one. At certain periods of my life, music's been intensely important to me, and I've listened to a lot. Classical music. And at other periods, it's sort of fallen away. And for one reason or another, mainly sort of pressure of inordinate amounts of reading that I was doing or writing, I haven't listened to music for a long period. And so going back into some of those past periods and remembering and digging out records of the pieces that I've loved in the past has been it's almost been like a sort of archaeology of the emotions for me.
Well, you started by learning the piano, and this isn't an introduction to any old simple piano piece. This is a piece by Debussy of great artistic merit.
Yeah, far beyond my capabilities. When I was a teenager, my parents dutifully sent me off to the local piano teacher, Miss Martin. And I remember her very clearly. She knew very little about music, I'm afraid, because I remember the first time I heard a Mahler symphony on the radio, I was very excited, and I dashed off to my music teacher to ask who is this person Mahler, and she hadn't heard of him. But there she was. She was a dear lady. She lived with her aged mother in a little cramped apartment that smelt very strongly of tomcats. So this music also brings back a scent as well.
A sensory journey.
And on the top of her piano, I remember there was a row of big, impressive-looking volumes with gilt titling of a sort of theosophist persuasion, and they all had titles like Increase the Power of Your Personality Through the Law of the Pharaohs, and that sort of thing. So I learnt the rudiments of the piano from Miss Martin, and I persuaded myself that I could play extremely expressively and extremely poetically, but I was always hopelessly incorrect, so I think my performances were clutches of wrong notes, beautifully rendered. Anyway, this piece is a Debussy piano piece, La Plus Que Lente, and it's La Plus Que Difficile as well, I must say. So in my fantasies, this is how I'm playing it.
Thank you.
Debussy's, I think, nostalgic waltz there, La Plus Collante. Certainly it seemed that way in that performance, didn't it? Alexis Weissenberg played on that recording. Well, Tim Robinson, you people of your generation were ideally placed to catch the wave of modernism in the 60s. What are your memories of that time?
Yes, in the early 60s, we were living in Vienna. I was beginning a career as a painter there, and that's where I had my first exhibitions. And we went to a good number of avant-garde concerts, including quite exciting ones in which people got very angry and walked out and so on. It was wonderful. It was like being at the first night of Hernani or one of these notorious 19th century events. I remember of a very early John Cage concert before he was well known at all. And I can't remember what the piece was called, but it was very strange. He was conducting it. And in the middle of it, he stopped conducting and he took hold of his music stand and started to edge it sideways across the stage with a little squeaking, scratching noise. And he moved very, very slowly leftwards until he disappeared into the wings. And it looked sensational, of course. And there were boos and catcalls and people walked out. It was great fun.
Especially in Vienna, where it's an art-conservative city, isn't it, as far as music's concerned?
Well, maybe it is nowadays, or was at that period, but apart from odd concerts like that. But those sort of Dadaist, conceptualist larks of John Cage didn't actually mean very much to me. And it was when I came across some music of Stockhausen in concerts in London a little later in the 60s. I do remember this concert hall with the notes, the tones, being bandied around the whole concert hall from loudspeaker to loudspeaker behind us and all around us, and noises whistling past our ears like ballistic missiles. It was very exciting. And I think that actually did have some influence on the artwork I was doing at that time, which was about spatial extents, the ideas, the sensations of moving around in a landscape and perhaps orientating yourself by noises, as I used to go for long walks in London at that time and try to orientate myself by the sun and by the sound of railway tracks that I knew of in the distance. So it was a sort of oral geography. And here on that occasion, there were sounds all around, and another parallel, I suppose, would be birdsong and the overlapping territories that birds establish for themselves by singing competitively against each other. I've written a little bit about that somewhere as well. So I was interested in Messiaen's birdsong music at that time as well.
Messiaen's pupil, though, we're going to hear now, isn't it? Pierre Boulez.
He had
a fantastic impact on, well, the London music scene at that time.
I'm sure he revolutionised the London music scene. And yes, I do remember one concert. It must have been in the Festival Hall. And one of the pieces was advertised one that Boulez had been at work on and was always amending and tinkering with over decades. And probably he hasn't finished it yet, so as I know. But we were to hear the latest version of it anyway. But then right at the last moment, it was announced that we weren't going to hear the latest version of it. We were going to hear something else instead. And when the orchestra filed on, it seemed to me they looked petrified. They looked white, ashen. They had obviously just suffered the great telling off of their lives for not being good enough to perform this piece.
Well, he's certainly a very exacting conductor because his ears are absolutely fantastic. He can detect minuscule deviations from the score. But what's the piece of his you've chosen to play?
This is a bit from Pli Selon Pli, which is a setting of some Mallarmé poems. It's a very atmospheric, and like all Mallarmé poems, they're largely incomprehensible, especially when you can't really make out the words, as in this setting. But Pli Selon Pli, the title has always intrigued me, apart from anything else. Fold, according to fold, fold upon fold. In the original Mallarmé poem, it refers to the way he sees, Mallarmé visits the city of Bruges and sees bits of it appearing through the mist, as if one fold of it appeared after another fold, it unfolds before him. And I'm sure that title has had some influence on me, making maps that fold up and running a map-making business called Folding Landscapes. So this is an improvisation on Mallarmé poem from Pli Salon Pli.
Seemed almost too delicate to be a full orchestral piece, but that was the BBC Symphony Orchestra with Phyllis Brynjolfsson negotiating the tricky vocal lines of Pierre Boulez's own improvisation on Mallarmé Pli Salon Pli. And Tim Robinson, I knew you would be fascinated by that title because from what I've read of your books on the West of Ireland. I get this idea of you now that you're fascinated by little snippets of phrases and references to, you know, the literary canon, people by, you know, phrases by Proust, you know, situations in Proust, Ruskin.
Ruskin in particular, there's all sorts of little references, hidden references, obviously not quite hidden if you've picked them up, into Ruskin in Stones of Ireland, including the title, of course. Ruskin wrote The Stones of Venice, and I shortened mine to Stones of Arran. I didn't want to claim to have covered all the stones of Arran, or even the most important ones.
But maybe his stones, did he not mean, you know, sculptures?
He meant carved buildings. Stones. He meant fine buildings, sculptures, finials, and so on. I'm making the assertion in using that title that the Stones of Arran and the rough-and-ready stones in the field walls and in the little early oratories of Arran and in the great dunes on the hilltops and clifftops are every bit as important, as beautiful, as culturally rich as the stones of Venice.
And adaptable and versatile.
Yes,
it's amazing to read how you've pointed out the use to which the stones have been put as gates, as obviously, you know, walls.
That's right, yes.
Tools.
Yes, and you find ancient structures reused. It's as if some of the, you know, the Arran Island farmers of earlier in this century and early in the 20th century and in the 19th century had been working shoulder to shoulder with Neolithic farmers and Bronze Age farmers, shifting the same stone around.
In the same sorts of ways.
Yes, very frequently.
And it's that intrigues, isn't it? I mean, you like the landscape, but it strikes me you also admire the way that the people have made use of the landscape.
Yeah, extremely close woven. It's an extremely close woven cultural landscape as well as physical landscape. That is what intrigued me in Arran. The whole surface area of the island is divided up minutely into little fields. And most of these fields have individual names and the little paths, the borings that run to them. So there's a very closely woven web of reference, and so many stories told about each of these places. And if you're collecting the name of a field, then you have to listen to a long account of who it belonged to and who he got it from and who he married and so on and so forth. And by the end of it, that field is linked on to almost every other field in the island. So it's a great fractal web.
It wasn't perhaps your idea originally. I think a postmistress gave you the idea of mapping the Aran Isles. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. I'd gone there having decided that I wanted to be a writer and was looking for a quiet place to do some experiments in that line. So we moved to Aran in 1972, and it had not really been explored in any very great detail. So there were lots of little things to be discovered on it. So gradually I found that the only thing I was writing was a diary, and I wrote volumes and volumes. I have stacks of volumes of diary that, in a way, I've been living off ever since. It was an incredibly intense experience for many years there. I was wondering what on earth I was going to do with all this material that I was gathering, and also how we were going to survive there. And yes, the postmistress said, "Oh, Tim, why don't you make a map?" And I thought, what a wonderful idea. It never occurred to me. And I started that night, drawing out a sketch map and beginning to plan how I would do it. And so I was approaching maps, of course, not from a sort of official cartographical point of view, but from the point of view of an artist working in whatever medium came to hand. So sometimes I bless the lady from the post office, and sometimes I think, gosh, she caused a detour of about 20 years in my life.
It's strange to imagine you huddling in that cottage in 1972 with no electricity throughout a winter with a cassette of this next piece to keep you company, because it's incredibly, not that Aran's not sophisticated, but it's incredibly, not quite metropolitan, but it's by Monteverdi. Mm-hmm. It's for a courtly environment. It's a sophisticated love story of Tancredi and Clorinda.
That's right, yes. Some friends of ours in Aran, in London, were very worried about us moving out of civilization, as they saw it, into the Aran Islands, and so they would send us the odd bit of music to remind us of what civilization was all about, and this was one. And because we played it so often, I suppose, and in such isolation and in such storms rattling the windows outside, that it all became incredibly hyper active with meaning. Yes, this combat of Tancred and Clorinda, it's based on a work by Tasso, and Tancred is a crusading knight, and he's in love with Clorinda, but Clorinda, for reasons which it would take a little long to explain and which I've totally forgotten, is fighting for the infidels in her armour and is, of course, completely unrecognisable. Mm. The two of them meet on the plain of battle and fight by night, and they have a magnificent fight which impresses them so marvellously that they stand back to admire each other, and Tancred asks what is his opponent's name, and she won't tell him. And he's furious at this, and they fall to hammering each other again. And it always seemed to me to have something to do with some difficulties in man-woman relationships. They seem to me to be hacking away at each other in the darkness, unknown, not knowing who each other were, with the horrible intimacy of lovers quarrelling in bed. Now, at the end, Clorinda is wounded, and her helmet is removed, and Tancred recognises his beloved. She's converted to Christianity at the last moment. It's a wonderful moment in which that happens. And then at the very, very last moment of the piece, the heavens open above her, and her soul ascends.
Hai vista, hai conoscenza, non mori già, che sue virtute colse tutte in quel punto, in guarda il cor le mise, e premendo il suo affanno ad arsi volse, vita con l'acqua chi col ferro uccise. Gioia trasmutò si e rise e in aria morì, lieta e vivace dir parea.
Beautifully moving use of the strings there to change colour. That's one of the things I find most fascinating about Monteverdi, how he changes the colours like on a kaleidoscope behind the voices.
Yes, it's wonderfully rich stuff.
Yeah. That was the William Christie recording with Les Arts Florissants. And Tim Robinson, I imagine it's a different recording from the one you're used to, but I imagine equally powerful.
Yes, and I remember on the back of the little cassette of Tancred and Clorinda that we had, there were some madrigals. There was one of those called Amor, which I think is the most erotic piece of music I've ever come across. It has a sort of psychic attack to it. And it makes me think, actually, of a peculiar comparison, but Nana Mouskouri singing Agape Mou, which we used to hear in the, when we were visiting Greece in the 50s and the 60s, but Amor, yes, it's got a pulsing rhythm to it. It's a very modern sounding piece. It's Renaissance catwalk music.
The voice of Annelise Monkowitz with that wonderfully erotic, as you say, Tim, madrigal by Monteverdi called Amor. Well, Tim Robinson's my guest on Calling the Tune today. We'll be hearing more of his choice of music, more about his experiences in Connemara and on Arran, and we'll be dipping into his new series of essays called My Time in Space. And you're listening to Lyric 96 to 99 FM with me, Sandy Burnett, and Tim Robinson, who's sitting alongside me in the studio in Calling the Tune this week. Tim, there have been a lot of changes in the west of Ireland in your time there, 30 years, and in particular the environmental movement has got off the ground on one hand, and great commercialisation and tourism has got off the ground on the other. I mean, do you find it much more factionalised now?
Yes, I think there are certain difficulties in Connemara and in Arran due to the pressure of development, the pressure to develop, and the possibility of making money. Some of these developments have been quite good and some quite damaging. At the moment, I'm very concerned about a scheme for putting a wind farm on the south shores of Inishman, which I think would be a dreadful thing to do. It wouldn't be big enough to make any noticeable contribution to the problem of global warming, which is a very genuine problem. It wouldn't be big enough to help with that particularly, but it would be big enough to very, very badly degrade an untouched, unspoiled, pristine, late 18th century, early 19th century landscape of field walls and boreens, which, as I say, is virtually uninterrupted, virtually untouched the whole length of the Atlantic coast of the three islands. And to have something like three wind turbines sticking up 150 feet high in such a landscape of low, level, flowing lines, greyness, silence, wildflowers, is to me a sort of blasphemy.
So it's like a visual pollution, I suppose, the way you'd put it.
Yeah, and people say, oh, well, you know, visual, that's just for artists and so on. But it's not true. I mean, the islanders themselves are very conscious of the beauty of their own island, and several of them are very, very distressed by the falling off in that precious quality of the place they live in.
Already?
Oh, yes, already.
Mm-hmm. In what way?
Ugly buildings, careless developments, needless interference with the course of nature. I mean, one of the first things that happened with the preparatory work for putting in the wind farm was that one of the boreens, one of these walled stony tracks running from the central ridge of the island down to the south, the Atlantic coast of the island, was sprayed with weed killer. Now, I happened to go along it just after this had happened, and so it was like a sort of brown desert going through this lovely flowery landscape, and you walked through this brown, deathly track down to the site, and beyond that, the rest of the boreen was knee-high in wildflowers, and there were hundreds of moths, the six-spot burnet moths, just hatching out from their pupae among these flowers. Now, that seemed to me that something dreadful had been done, much, much more important than a practical consequence. Mm. Something ethical, something deeply damaging to the world had been done there.
Well, let's get the spirit of, well, not of Arran, but of Connemara, where you now live. Mm. Here's a song from South Connemara.
Yeah, I learnt a good deal of Irish while I was in Arran, and then used it a lot when I was researching South Connemara and the place names there. It's got very rusty now, so I won't I won't use any of it. But and also I became very interested in the local song tradition. That's the Shan Nos, the old way of singing. And this, in a way, is a difficult art for the outsider to penetrate for various reasons, apart from the difficulty of the language, and which is dialect, you know. But the songs are packed with very particular local references to places and people. And often enough, the songs don't tell a story, but they're a commentary on a story that one is supposed to know as part of one's heritage that one learnt from one's grandmother's knee. So unless a certain amount of that is explicated, then the outsider doesn't really get what the song is about, and it may sound just like a pretty dreadful caterwauling. I was introduced to these songs by Brian O'Rourke, who produced a book and with a cassette called Blas Mala, A Taste from the Honeypot, which has some of these South Connemara songs on, beautifully sung in Irish on one side, and on the other side sung in a singable English version. And that's a very, very useful introduction to the idea. Mm. This particular song is Auron Winsha, the song of Muinish. And what interested me, of course, was these place name references. Now, this song was written, I think, about the end of the last century by a lady from Muinish, which is one of the islands off South Connemara. And she had married into another island, Letta Kala, a little bit east of there. And when she was old and felt death coming upon her, she wanted to be taken back to Muinish and buried in the beautiful graveyard on the sandy shoreline of Muinish there. And this song is her giving her instructions. And they are actually her instructions. I mean, this song is for real. The woman is foreseeing her own death. She is laying out the details of her own funeral. She describes exactly who is to lay her out, what she's to be wearing, where the boards for the coffin are to come from, who is to sail the boat back to Muinish, with a proviso, so long as the day isn't too rough, because she's a genuine, real South Connemara woman and she knows how dangerous that can be. So if the day's not too rough, they're to sail by a certain route back to Muinish. She names the various little places they pass. She ends with describing the scene on the grave, on the beach where the graveyard is, and the song ends with these beautiful words, Beisailse en adúchana, is nive ugnes on. There will be lights on the sand dunes, and there will be no loneliness there.
Agus kiare gimach mochon shom es fiars goiawn y glor smata shan o Ach si din ton lan Spiach ma chepin Samar e binin tishti Sied gori eser Agus trwy'r benog o'n eisleifft ag o'n le me chwyn os cyn Wegnes aroma.
It strikes me, as well as being what it's ostensibly about, a voyage of death, a voyage of dying, it's also a celebration of the landscape, isn't it? The topography, the coastline.
It is, yes. These are places that are closely known and deeply loved by these people, where they spent their life gathering seaweed and planting potatoes and so on. Very hard life, of course, but had great beauty attached to it. I think this art of Llanos is also a celebration of the Irish language as well, because I remember writing a note for Brian O'Rourke about this and saying that because of the extraordinarily rich and complex phonetics of Irish words, I can imagine that Irish words have more space, more echoey spaces inside them than English words. And that's why I wrote about an Irish word which is so spacious you could hold a ceilidh dance in one syllable and a wake in the other without mutual interference. And I think Llanos is the art that dwells in these echoey spaces inside Irish words and celebrates them.
Whereas musically, of course, it's very simple, isn't it? It's strophic, repetitive.
Mm.
But it's the language that carries you forward into each verse.
Yes, there's an argument going on. There's a story being told and so on. And and there is this repetitive, slow repetitive rhythm of like waves coming in on the beaches there.
We're on a similar theme in the next piece you've chosen in today's programme, Tim Robinson. It's a piece by Arvo Pärt, which he's a contemporary composer who dwells very much in the past. He deals with the timelessness of music, with using elements of great simplicity, as here.
Yes, I don't know very much about him. I've heard one or two pieces on the radio, that's all. But I went to the Belfast Festival a few years ago. I was doing a reading there, and we stayed on to go to some concerts, and one was of minimalist music. I think it was mainly Steve Reich. And one of the pieces was this Arvo Pärt, a cantata in memoriam Benjamin Britten. It's very, very beautiful.
Thank you.
Naima Järvi conducted the strings of the Scottish National Orchestra, and their bell player in that cantus in memoriam of Benjamin Britten by Arvo Pärt. And that's probably as spiritual a kind of music as you're going to get in this secular age.
Yes, I'm sure it is. The minimalists seem to go in, as they say, for holy minimalism, and I don't quite know what the connection is. That's not the case in the visual arts, where nothing could be less religious than Donald Judd or an artist like that. This whole question of this of spirituality in art is a problem for us. It's a problem for me as a non-believer. I remember a few years ago, we went to Aix-en-Provence and found, just by chance, that it was the tail end of the musical festival, which we didn't know about, and we couldn't get into some of the things because we were booked up. I remember trying to listen to Monteverdi's Vespers through the keyhole of the cathedral there, which wasn't too successful. But we did get into a wonderful performance of Mozart's Requiem Mass in the cathedral. And at that time, I was thinking about and writing about the problem of what are cathedrals for in this secular age. One can't let the whole past of religious art, explicitly religious art, like those cathedrals and like Mozart's Requiem, go. And it's very difficult to translate their points of reference into whatever would be meaningful for me now. So it's an unresolved problem and a conflict for me. I remember this particular very beautiful performance of the Requiem Mass. Every note was crystalline in the cathedral. And I was looking up at the cathedral roof. It's a Gothic cathedral, and it was crisscrossed by shadows. It was the deep groining and the complexity of this tapestry of shadows over it. And suddenly it was as if I was looking up into the interior of my own skull. And it was the size of a mountain. It was like looking up into a mountain from within a mountain. And it had room for all sorts of unknown, unexplored capacities. So maybe there's something in these religious arts that it does refer to a very deep reality, not the one that's explicit on the surface of it, but something which maybe we can find our way back to. I think the piece I'd like to hear now from that mass is the Rex Tremendi Majestatis, and of course this is a direct challenge. I mean, this is a paean of praise to a male god. It could be to Jove.
I love how it turns the corner at the end.
Mm.
That sort of a penitent, sorrowful section really transforms the movement.
Yes, it does. It becomes quite quiet and interiorized.
That's an extract from the Mozart Requiem. But do you also take time to listen to intimate music, solo works, as well as full-scale orchestral ones and choral ones?
Oh, of course, yes. You know, some bits of music are just pure pleasure to listen to, sheer physical delight. I'm envious of musicians. I'd love to be able to play an instrument, but more than that, I'd love to be able to write music. But then I'm envious of mathematicians and cosmologists and all sorts of other people as well, but particularly of musicians. And as a writer, the facility, the openness and possibility that music has to repeat itself lingeringly and to get better as it repeats itself is one that I deeply envy. You can't do that in writing. Any repetition in writing tends to fall flat, just the reader skips it.
Well, I suppose it would be rhetoric that would be the only analogy, wouldn't it?
That's right, yes, a sort of patterned repetition with a change advancing through it. But to take a whole passage and to do it again, you know, the writers of the Nouvelle Vague did that with rather disastrous effects in the 60s. And some of the most tedious books of theirs are ones in which whole passages are repeated. And one just doesn't read them, one just skips them. But with the music, you can lay down a lovely melody and then you can do it again. And then for sheer love of it, do it again.
Well, this Schubert Impromptu, which is your last choice this week, does exactly that. The B-flat Impromptu D935 by Schubert was played there by Rudolf Buchbinder. Buchbinder, which Tim Robinson reminds me that your latest collection of essays, My Time in Space, has just been published by Lilliput Press. We were talking about that earlier on. Mm-hmm. Well, I must say it's been a great pleasure to delve into the various facets of your mind, the artist, the cartographer, the map maker, the writer, the thinker, secularist. Thank you very much for coming to the studio today.
It's been a fascinating experience for me too. Thank you very much.
The late Tim Robinson, who died in April 2020, was Sandy Burnett's guest in 2001 in that Calling the Tune special from the RTE Lyric FM archive. The Lyric feature is available as a podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and also from the RTE Radio Player and the RTE Lyric FM website. You can contact the Lyric feature by email, features.lyricfm@rte.ie.